Bandwidth for the Steam Podcast is provided by the Internet Archive at www.archive.org. This is the Steam Podcast, episode number 3, for Sunday, September 24th, 2006. Intro version. Welcome to episode 3 of the Steam Podcast. Here tonight we have myself, Bob Summers. We also have Ramsey Beckett from the Steam Forums.
Hello.
We also have with us Thomas Arundel, who is the commercial director for Introversion Software, makers of Darwinia, Uplink, and coming this Friday, DEF CON. So he will be with us for the interview segment of the podcast. But yeah, kind of an odd time. It's about 6 a.m. here on the West Coast, so I actually have not gone to sleep at all. But finally, an appealing interview time for Ramsey.
Exactly.
So he gets his revenge tonight for me making him appear groggy on the podcast for the last few episodes.
Last episode.
So
let's go ahead and get started.
The latest news.
What's happening in your world?
The stuff you care about. The latest news.
This is probably the number one story right now. Valve announces dynamic weapons pricing for Counter-Strike Source. The cost of weapons and equipment that you purchase in Counter-Strike Source are now based on an algorithm that calculates the global market demand for various weapons. As more people purchase a certain weapon, the price will rise and other weapons will become less expensive. Interesting move.
Very interesting.
And actually a lot of people were saying there was no hint of this whatsoever.
Yeah.
Normally you can figure out one way or another what Valve is working on next, or they'll, you know,
exactly,
working on, you know, some player models, or we're working on a new map, or
A phase, they were working on the player models and the HDR, and we all got the gist of that, but this was just totally
This was completely
direction.
Out of the blue. And the thing is, they're launching this on October 11th, so it's not like they just decided yesterday this is something they're going to try. I mean, they've obviously been working on this for a while now.
Yeah.
And very controversial, though, in the forums. There's a huge thread in the Steam-powered forums. Some people like the idea. They think it's cool. Some people have said, well, this is it. Not playing Counter-Strike Source anymore. Which I think is a little extreme. But, you know, it's... The important part of it is that it's not extreme. I mean, for example, you're not going to see a $12,000 M4 because everybody buys the M4. You know, it's all reasonably controlled. I mean, from the projected prices they have for weapons moving, for the first projected prices, I mean, the most expensive change was on the M4, and it went up, I think it was $300.
And that's still just a projected estimation. I mean, that's
exactly
final.
Exactly. But there's a lot of people who want to, who are asking Valve to make this a, because right now what it will be is all servers will just do this. They will log weapons that people are buying and everything like that. And then I think once a week or once a day or something like that, the server phones home to Valve and basically uploads the list of weapons that people have been purchasing. But and then on a weekly basis, they update the prices of all the weapons. A lot of people have been asking Valve to make this a server CVAR that they can basically turn off, which I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, it's pretty reasonable.
I think it's reasonable. And especially, I mean, I can definitely see why Cal and some of the other leagues out there would want that. It's, you know, while it's a cool thing, it's the fluctuation of it just makes it a little too... you know, unpredictable for consistent league play. As one of the guys in the forums brought up, you know, let's say that a crap load of people the previous week bought AKs, you know, and your strat for this particular map on the terrorist side involves getting AKs as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you're kind of screwed now because, you know, you may not be able to actually purchase those AKs because they're so expensive. So it's, you know, it's, personally, I think it's kind of cool, and I think it's a direction that nobody else has moved in before, and it's nice to see Valve trying to do something that nobody else has done before, you know what I mean?
Well, it's completely different. I mean, an online economy for an FPS is really something that's never, ever been even mentioned or done before by anyone else. So it's pretty interesting the direction they're going.
Yeah, it's certainly, and also I like the idea of it not being just on a server-by-server basis, too. I mean, this is a global community thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not just, okay, well, everybody on this server buys Deagles, so that's going to become ridiculously expensive, you know.
And it's funny that you mention that, though, because, like, on the website we can see there's nearly a $300 increase in the Deagle, so, I mean, that's going to mean that no more Deagle during the first pistol round, so it's going to really, really change the way people are going to be playing this game, so.
That's right, that's a very good point. So, it's, you know, I think it's a good thing, though, also, because it seems to me that when it comes to Counter-Strike Source, a lot of people, there are maybe three or four weapons that most people use on a regular basis, and there are some weapons that nobody really ever touches. And I think this is a nice kind of incentive thing to get people to use a larger variety of weapons and kind of adapt their gameplay to fit those weapons, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, people seem to be complaining about the fact things are going to get cheaper, I mean, more expensive. No one has mentioned the fact that things are going to be getting cheaper, too. So
exactly.
That's a pro.
Exactly. So either way you look at it, definitely head over to the Steam Powered User Forums. Check out the 500-something posts that have been made in this thread. I'm sure it is still there, or still be will there by the time the podcast comes out. So check that out. Definitely very interesting developments from Valve, and we will be following this closely. And we'll see how it all plays out on October 11th, and we will report back. That is for sure. Valve released his updates for Steam and the Source Engine. Valve released two updates this week, one for the Steam client and another one for the multiplayer components of the Source Engine. The Steam update fixed a bug where the Steam windows would get moved around when you played a low-resolution full-screen game, and they also fixed a bug which gave users an access denied error when trying to play a media file. I didn't personally experience either one of those bugs, but
me neither.
I didn't experience the Half-Life 2 stutter bug either, so, you know, that's not to say it didn't exist. And I'm sure that one did exist, because there were a lot of people that were pretty pissed about that.
Oh, yeah.
But also, the Source multiplayer update fixed a console command exploit that could be used to crash multiplayer servers. Not a good thing. And they also fixed a bug that caused a game crash when swapping teams. So, again, not much in terms... I mean, really the only exciting Steam news this week was Valve's announcement of the dynamic pricing structure for Counter-Strike Source. And believe me, we were, just like last week, it was getting up near the time of the podcast, and I was like, oh man, come on, Valve, give me something to work with here. Two updates, that's not going to go very far here. But, and then, you know, my wish was answered there with that interesting announcement.
Certainly.
Sony's keynote speech at TGS, the Tokyo Game Show, called, quote, a meltdown, a total disaster, and a train wreck. Wow, this is interesting. Apparently, Sony's Ken Kutaragi made some big mistakes at his TGS keynote speech. Major problems stemmed from the fact that the translators who they had translating... were stumbling over common terms like VOIP and used such a limited vocabulary that it made Kutaragi sound like a repetitive rambler, basically. And
definitely not good.
Yeah, no kidding. Kutaragi kept mentioning the word computer over and over and over, and it's really kind of unclear whether he was actually... He never said the word console in the entire keynote speech. My guess is that maybe the translators translated the word console into computer, but he kept talking about computers and how great they are, and it's just like most of the people in the audience were just thinking, I don't care. You know, tell me something.
The PS3.
Exactly, give me something about the PS3 here. You know, Kutaragi also went on and on and on and on about how great the internet is and how many possibilities it has, you know, and everybody in the audience is, you know, sitting on the edge of their seat thinking, all right, come on, give me something about, you know, the online, you know, capabilities of the PS3 here, you know, I'm ready, give it to me. But nothing mentioned in the keynote about that at all. Very few visual aids were used. Reportedly, roughly 80% of the speech was nothing but Kutaragi just standing there and speaking. Not a good thing when you're at a game show, because what people like to see in keynotes is lots of demonstrations, lots of, you know, glitz, glamour, and show. And
not some old guy talking about how great the internet is.
Exactly, exactly. At the end of the speech, when the lights dimmed for the final video, everyone was apparently waiting at the edge of their seat in hopes that they would finally get a glimpse of something exciting about the PS3. Instead, they were quickly disappointed by a video of one of the PS3's least anticipated games, Africa.
Awesome. Not really. I honestly have never heard a game like that, and honestly, it doesn't really sound like such an awesome game. Because
it's not. I was reading the thing about it, and it said it looks amazing, but it's basically think of like watching and caring for wildlife on your PS3.
It's a dream I've had since I was a boy.
Oh, exactly.
It does look like an awesome game. I'm looking at the screenshots right now. It looks really nice.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, is that it looks amazing. It's just
thousands of antelopes and stuff.
Yeah. It's unfortunate that it's so boring. it's a nice screensaver for your PS3.
Probably. $100 screensaver.
Yeah, no kidding. Although, here we go. Here's an interesting article, though. The PS3 kind of redeems itself later. Sony demos the PS3 interface at TGS. Unfortunately, no real pictures or anything are available. You can't really find them anywhere because Sony was pretty strict about making sure that people had their cameras and recording devices turned off. But this is what we know, so try and visualize this in your head if you can. The PS3 interface is basically going to be based on the cross-media bar that should be familiar to anybody who has a PSP. The PS3 will also have a firmware update system, much like the PSP, and these updates will add more functionality to the PS3 over time. That's a good thing, because we've seen a lot of functionality been added to the PSP, and I think that really almost helps justify the higher price of it, because, I mean, when you buy a system that's not ever going to change, that's a little bit more of a risky investment, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when you buy something knowing that, hey, well, this doesn't have this particular feature that I really want now, but they have the ability to add that in the future by updating the firmware, that's definitely a big plus. And things such as the PS3 theme will also be tweaked and updated over time. The PS3 will also feature a media station. This is pretty cool. At least it sounds pretty cool. Enabling it to play movies, picture slideshows, listen to music, and more, all with full 1080p resolution, which is good for HDTV owners.
Very good.
The PS3 will also include a fully fledged web browser, allowing you to view multiple websites, all being displayed in multiple windows. Anyway, so it's interesting because it makes it seem like with all these interface features and stuff like that, they're really pushing it like it's a game console, but it's also a media center PC, you know.
It's packed with a lot of features, and I mean, you know, why I remember ages ago when I was deciding whether to buy a PS2 or a DVD, I mean, all I had to do was just buy one thing. So I mean, if this is going to replace a lot of things I have to buy, then awesome, send it on.
Exactly. And I mean, they pretty much got to stuff it full of features if they want to justify the price that they're going to be asking for it, you know?
Yeah.
Especially when you've got something like the Wii that's at half the price point, you know? PS3 price drop, a sign of weakness? Mike Wallace, a U.S. analyst, calls the new price drop for the 20-gigabyte PlayStation 3 in Japan a, quote, questionable business decision. Stating that Sony said it made the move in response to consumer complaints about the console's price. Wallace paints the decision as a window dressing at most. Sony's Ken Kutaragi said yesterday in Japan, Sony would cut the price for the lower-end PS3, with the one with the 20-gigabyte hard drive, to less than 50,000 yen from an original 60,000 yen, or for roughly in U.S. dollars, $429 U.S. dollars from an original 515. Quote, this price cut is only on the 20-gigabyte version of the PS3 in Japan, which in our view is not significant given that the U.S. is the key market for the PS3. Wallace said in his memo.
Odd.
A price cut is a price cut. I mean, you can analyze it all you want, but, you know, I think what it is I think he's a financial analyst that's basically making recommendations for people who are buying and selling Sony stock.
Mm.
But it's...
But for it to be on a game website like GameSpot, it really doesn't matter to people like us.
Yeah,
a price drop is a price drop. It's good. We'll take it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, okay, look, Mike Wallace, some guy, says that Sony, it's a sign of weakness that the PS3 is dropping in price. I don't care if they're weak. I just want to buy their console for less money. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's like, you just... Sony's one of the... Honestly, Sony's one of those mega giants that's not going away anytime soon. So, we already know that the PS3 is in a weak position, if you will. The Xbox was released. Xbox 360 was released. It was a huge success. The Wii has got so much rolling for it right now. People are just are itching to get their hands on a Wii to try it out. And the PS3 has really been taking the back seat on everything in terms of publicity. I mean, people would talk about it, but then it gets superseded by 10 stories about the Wii, you know?
Yeah.
So it's...
Well, it's a smart business decision from Sony because, as I said last week, there's the Wii ready for Christmas, there's the Xbox 360 ready for Christmas, and then the PS3 is coming out after Christmas for Australia. It's coming out in March 2007. Mm-hmm. So this seems like just a natural decision. Reduce the price. People will go for it.
Yeah.
It's just a huge savings in Japan, though.
Yeah. And that's weird, though, that it's in Japan because, as Wallace noted, that Sony has shifted their major market from Japan to the U.S. with the PS3. So, one would think that they would do the biggest, or do the price drop, if they're only going to do it in one market, that they would do it in
the one that matters the most.
Exactly. I don't know. It's difficult. I mean, any price drop, I think, is a good thing, but I'm just curious why they chose just Japan.
Mm.
You know, I don't...
It could be because I remember Kutaragi mentioning that they would be losing money on each PS3 console lost, and that, mm-hmm. you know, the price that they set down was actually the bare minimum that they would need before they would, you know, start losing money.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in them reducing the price in such a massive market like America, I mean, they would be, you know, losing billions, I guess. So,
yeah,
I mean,
that's true. Oh, sorry, I had to yawn.
Yeah, no problem.
Oh, it's getting late.
But, what time is it over there?
Oh, 6:49 a.m., and I have not been to sleep yet. So believe me, as soon as this podcast is over, I am crashing. But, you know, it's... I don't know. I'm not really sure what to make of it yet, because I suppose it's quite possible that he wants to give a price cut in Japan so that a ton of Japanese will go out and buy it, and then just, you know, screw the people in the U.S. They can pay regular price to compensate for Japan's price cuts. But I'm sure they would never come out and actually officially say that, because that would, you know, piss all of us off and make us not buy PS3s.
Exactly.
Not like we're going to buy a PS3 in the Wii anyway, because we'll all be having too much fun with our Wiis, but... Yeah, whatever. Battlefield 2142 shoots down gold. On the game's official website, publisher Electronic Arts has announced that the game has gone gold. Battlefield 2142 is set for release on October 17th. I'm excited about this. I have not... Is there a demo available, Ramsey?
Currently, the demo is slated to be released within the next couple of weeks, but they've been doing an open beta, which closed about 2 weeks ago.
Okay. So,
and I really have to say that it was so painfully disappointing to play it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
A lot of what everyone said, and including myself, was Battlefield 2142 felt like a skin or a mod for Battlefield. It didn't feel like I was playing a game that deserved, in my view, $100. In your case, $50 in the States.
Really? Wow. That's unfortunate, because, I had read a lot of stuff about it, and, you know, all the new... basically everything that was going to be new about 2042, and I was getting pretty excited about it. And, oh, that's really a shame to hear that it didn't live up to the hype.
Everyone, like, I myself was very excited about it, but, I mean, as soon as you got into the game, you started to notice that the things Battlefield 2 itself was known for, you know, like, not being able to navigate the ground very well, you know, bumping off objects, bumping into teammates, cars, randomly, you know, stopping and crashing and not being able to handle certain hills. It just... it felt like I was playing Battlefield 2 with the skin, that's all.
Oh, wow. That's a bummer.
Yeah.
Metal Slug 6 Anthologized. SNK Playmore confirms that all the Metal Slug arcade games will be included in a single PSP or Wii game. When the Metal Slug series debuted on the Neo Geo 10 years ago, gamers had to part with hundreds of dollars to own a copy. Now that arcade action classic and six 2D Metal Slug sequels it spawned will all be available for the cost of a single PSP or Wii game. This is cool.
Very cool.
Just the idea of being able to get, what is it now, seven, I guess, that they've packaged together.
Yeah, pretty much.
Seven of these extremely popular arcade games on a single PSP game or a single Wii game. You know, I haven't seen very many arcade games that end up getting ported to handheld devices, and I don't know why. Because there are several arcade games that I used to play when I was younger, or that I still play now when I'm out at a pizza parlor or something like that, that I'd love to have that with me and take it with me everywhere I go. Not to mention it'd be a lot less expensive than
exactly
dumping it's all my quarters into a machine, so you know.
It's weird that it's taken them so long to notice that people love Metal Slug.
Yeah.
I mean, why haven't they done it earlier?
Yeah. Well, they probably will make a crun load of money off this. That's all I can say. Mm. You know, if they can get it out. I mean, part of the problem with taking smaller games or arcade games and then repackaging them and selling them is that they usually don't get a lot of publicity.
Something like Metal Slug, it sells itself. It's just
that's true. Having. That's true. All you got to do with Metal Slug is get the name out, and that will be the publicity factor.
Exactly.
So hopefully they do well with that, and I am awaiting that with much glee. She'll say that much.
Steam Podcast Interviews.
Talking to the people you want to hear from.
Asking the questions you want answers to. The Steam Podcast Interview starts now.
Okay, so here with us today we have Thomas Arundel, who is the commercial director for Introversion Software, makers of Darwinia and DEFCON, which is coming out on this Friday, I believe.
That's right, yep.
And so basically, just tell us a little bit about Introversion as a company, Tom.
All right, so probably best start by telling you how we got started, which was about 5 years ago, almost to the day actually. We left university and a friend of ours, Chris, he'd written a game called Uplink at university in the dorms. And Mark and I and Chris decided to get together and sell the game. And we started off with $1,000 between the three of us. We started making the units, you know, burning the CDs and printing out the labels and sticking them on. Mm-hmm. We took orders over the internet, and then within a couple of weeks, we made enough to buy a pallet load of CDs, which we could send out, which saved us a lot of time. And then within about 4 months, we made £100,000. And this was just for a couple of news postings on...
One
of them was on News Blues New, and there was another, I can't remember, but a couple of really busy forums, right? And it just spread really word of mouth, and that's how the ball sort of got rolling. And then from that, we were able to get for that success, we were able to get distribution into stores, and obviously that brought in a bit more money, and then we started working on our next game, Darwinia. Mm-hmm. We had a bit of a rocky ride with Darwinia. We had to take no salaries for 10 months and sell everything we owned on eBay to get through it. But we did make it through, just. And then Darwinia was obviously a critical success, not quite a commercial success until we put it on Steam.
Uh-huh.
Obviously that's kept us going well enough to get through to now, and we've got DEFCON coming out in about 5 or 6 days' time. Mm-hmm. So I guess the thing about Introversion is that we self-fund it, so we make our own games, so mm-hmm. we're truly independent. We just make the games that we want to make, so Uplink was about computer hacking, Darwinia was a very difficult game to describe, and even after 20 publisher pitches, I still can't describe it particularly easily. but it was a very cool game, from the heart. It was a really sort of inspired game. And DEFCON is, as you saw, it's, you can see it from the screenshots, it's inspired very heavily by the film War Games.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all have a secret inner feeling to be Matthew Broderick.
I do indeed.
So that's sort of how we got started and what we're about, really.
So, how did you guys come up with the game concept for Darwinia? I mean, it's a very unique style of gameplay, and I just never seen something like that done before.
Right. The inspiration came from there was this competition in the U.S. It was like an indie coding sort of get together, mm-hmm. and these guys realized that with today's high-powered graphics cards, instead of making a 10,000 poly model, you could paint 10,000 sprites using the same sort of graphical power, right? Mm-hmm. So you can have an on-screen, you can have an army of 10,000 sprites all marching over this sort of rugged landscape, and it looked quite a cool game. Mm. So that's sort of how Darwinia started off. It started off with a game called Future War. And the idea was you had these massive armies of these green, or these stick men, and they varied in color depending on which side you had. Mm. And you marched them over the landscape, and they sort of flying sort of ships that would fly around and sort of help with their attack. And it was like kind of a strategy game, but it looked kind of impressive because you could zoom all the way out, and there's this huge big armies all over the place. Mm-hmm. Even though they were very simple sort of sprites. But in terms of gameplay, it didn't really work out, and that's why Darwinia took 18 months longer than it was supposed to.
Oh, wow.
We had to scrap this idea of these massive armies that you were controlling, because it just wasn't very fun to play, and then focus much more on the sort of the real-time strategy, sort of arcade sort of style that we've got in Darwinia.
Mm-hmm.
But sort of graphically speaking, most of the inspiration came from things like Tron. You can sort of see that in the engineers and in the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
From old games, you know, the airstrike is delivered by a load of space invaders.
Mm-hmm.
Ships that look very similar to space invaders. There's some centipede monsters in there that sort of play like when you attack them, and if you shoot them, you can sort of cut them in half, just like in the original centipede game. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of really where it came from. And the green stick man, which is the Darwinia that you're trying to protect, or they're trying to save their planet,
mm-hmm.
Was just really an afterthought. And quite strangely, in many ways, it's actually become quite iconic. And people, they've repeatedly said to us, you know, this is one of your biggest brand assets. And we just can't really believe that this small stick man, this knocked up in an afterthought, is considered by some to be quite important.
Mm-hmm. So, PC Gamer gave Darwinia 90%. They called it a must-buy game for the PC. PC Format gave it 90%. IGN gave it 8.8 out of 10. Eurogamer gave it 9 out of 10. I mean, what's it like to meet that kind of success with your, first commercially released game?
Yeah, that was really awesome. We were kind of overwhelmed by the response. And in fact, we were also sort of thinking that the commercial success of the game would also sort of live up to that. So we had this huge wave of critical acclaim. But oddly enough, the distribution we were using at the time, you know, via the retail and via mail order via our website, didn't really live up to the expectations, or didn't match those sort of critical acclaim.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, you know, it really gave us a pat on the back. And because remember, we'd been through, like, I had to move back with my mum and dad, and we had so much total benefit for like 10 months, and really we had sold everything we'd ever owned on eBay, so we had nothing left.
Wow.
So to get that back was obviously an excellent start, and really sort of helped raise morale and keep everybody keen.
Mm-hmm. Now, Darwinia won 3 awards at the 2006 Independent Games Festival: technical excellence, innovation in visual art, and the overall grand prize. Was there ever a moment during the development of Darwinia where it crossed your mind that it could possibly be as hugely influential as it really was?
No. Actually, that really took us by surprise. Somebody said we didn't even know about the Independent Game Festival, and somebody just suggested us. I think one of the fans suggested to us that we should enter, because, you know, they said, well, we've got an independent game and it kind of fits the criteria, so why not put it in? And you had like $100 or something to enter the game into the competition. And we all just wanted to go to San Francisco anyway, so we obviously got the got a sort of free passage, because we entered the game in, and they accepted it as part of the games that they were going to enter into the competition.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, we got to the award ceremony, and somebody told us about the award ceremony, and they told us, well, actually, you know, this isn't like a UK award ceremony where you get a pat on the back and a few claps. This is like 2,000 people in an auditorium.
Oh, holy cow.
So we're kind of, I thought, well, we, you know, this is kind of important. We better dress up for this. This is an award. This is a proper award ceremony. So about 2 hours to spare, we raced around San Jose trying to find ourselves some black tie, you know, dinner jacket. And actually, we managed to do this. We got there just as the thing was starting. A few beers, a couple of Jack Daniels, I think, to give us a bit of Dutch courage. And the rest was a blur, you know. We won some awards. We managed to slur our speeches as one is supposed to do it, of course, at awards ceremonies. And we had a real awesome time, you know. So that was really top notch. And the nice thing was, because, you know, we were dressed up in the black tie after the event, mm-hmm. We're just walking down the street in San Jose, and people come up to us and say, "Hey, you know, well done, the Darwin. Yeah, that's really cool. You know, really like it." And so that was again, you know, just another. It's just a really nice, genuine sort of pat on the back, and well, that really sort of motivated us to continue, especially with the DEF CON.
That's cool. Hmm. So, what's it like being an independent game developer? I mean, like, what are some of the pros and cons that you get out of not working with, say, a larger game studio?
The pros are obvious. Probably the most obvious pro is that you have no constraints, so you can do what you want.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not going to have some other guy, you're not going to have a suit come in and say, "Hey, you know, there's a market for a space shooter. We think in about 9 months' time, any chance you could change this game into be a space shooter?" They're not going to mess up your game, or as Mark put it, I won't say exact words. They're not going to ruin your game, which was important for us. Other benefits are you can have a much more sort of relaxed lifestyle. We don't have a central office. We all sort of work from home. Some of us live in different countries, and you can be very flexible. So that's obviously another upside. And the other upside is that if your game does really well, then you're going to make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, is that you have to work bloody hard. You are constantly, you know, some months I've just come like 10 days to the end of the month, and I've got no idea how I'm going to pay the wage bill. Somehow we always manage to scrape through. Somehow some money comes in from someone, or, you know, so we've been quite lucky in that sense. But it can get quite stressful, because, you know, you obviously have to live and have to eat and have to pay the rent at the end of the month. So you can't, you know, because you're not backed by a large company, you can't really live this sort of lavish style. You can't rack up loads of debts. You know, you've always got to save some money away in case of a rainy day, in case the development time doubles again and something goes terribly wrong. It's a bit of a flip side. It's a different way of being, I think.
You mentioned that during the first game, Uplink, you really went through a lot of hardship in order to get it, you know, up and running. I mean, what has publishing with Steam done for your company in a whole? I mean, how easy is it to become to be a developer with Steam?
That's quite an interesting story too. Actually, we back in the summer last year, we went to a presentation, we went to a conference, and kind of well-known industry person said, I heard on the grapevine that Valve are going to open up Steam to third-party products as well. And I said, oh, that's kind of interesting. He said, well, you know, I think Darwin would work really well on it, so you should put it out there. You should go and get in touch with them. So I wrote off to Gabe Newell, and I didn't hear anything back, and I thought, okay, well, maybe the rumor was unconfirmed. And then 2 months later, I got an email back from one of the guys at Valve, and they were really keen to put it up there. It turns out that Gabe Newell's kids had really enjoyed Darwinia, and that, I think, quite heavily influenced his decision. Thanks, Gabe Newell's three-year-old. That was great. And thereafter, we were on Steam. I think it was the second non-Valve game that was on Steam. And, in the first 3 or 4 weeks, we made more back than we had done from a previous 6 months in retail in the UK, which we'd sort of set up ourselves. And of course, also there's like a credibility, because Valve's games are very highly polished and very high quality, so it was almost like an endorsement, right? You know, so people would see this game, you see the press release, it's coming out on Steam, oh, we should give it a go, you know, because maybe it's a bit better than we first thought. So that was very helpful as well. And I think in many ways that was probably helpful towards getting a huge amount of additional exposure in the US, which probably helped with our IGF win, and certainly helped probably also with some other distribution of physical goods that we did afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we did a deal with eGames to put the game in US retail.
Mm-hmm. So your upcoming game, DEF CON, is due to be launched September 29th, this Friday, on Steam.
That's right.
And it's based on the 1980s movie War Games, right?
Yeah, it's inspired by it. I have to say inspired, because if you say based, then they'll probably sue
well.
Copyright.
That's true.
It's clearly inspired. It looks pretty similar in some ways, yeah.
Okay, because that was actually one of my favorite movies. I was, as soon as I saw the screenshots and stuff like that, I immediately thought, oh wow, this looks like War Games.
Right.
Once I found that it actually had been inspired by War Games, I was pretty excited. I've already pre-ordered, and so there you go. I'm doing my job.
Cool.
To help you guys pay the rent.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Oh, no problem. And also, I noticed on your website you just recently started a DEF CON tournament with your beta testers.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. So,
and how has that gone? And do you think you'll keep running tournaments after the game is released?
Yeah, definitely. Well, the tournament for the beta testers was a dry run, if you like, for doing it for the public when the game is released.
Okay.
And it's worked out really well, actually, because DEF CON is a multiplayer game, so you have up to six players in the game. But one of the really cool things that makes the DEF CON work is the alliances you have. You can form an alliance with somebody, and you can share, for example, your radar coverage. You can see what status their silos are in, if they're in attack or defense mode.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they go to attack one of your neighbors, you could see that they've changed all their silos into attack mode, so they're pretty defenseless now, and you can do a sneaky attack against them, break the alliance, and really stab them in the back. So you get this whole sort of get this sort of whole cat and mouse, this whole Cold War tension, because you can also in the in-game chat talk to everybody, or you can talk to just your people in your alliance, or you can talk to some of the spectators who are you can also sort of log in to watch the game.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of a neat thing, and that works out really well for the tournament, because you get teams of people, like duos, and then you might find that one duo gets a bit cheesed off with the other one, and then someone else verts them away, and there's like a new little, so the people are constantly sort of forming and reforming these sort of little groups, these little cliques that they can use.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite fun to watch.
So can you give us maybe some extra tidbits here and there about DEF CON for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So we mean like tips and how to suggestions?
Well,
any
information.
I'm trying to think of what hasn't already been said, what I can say that's unique. So DEF CON is probably one a few little tips I'll give you. One is when you're playing DEF CON, one of the very useful things to do is you've got to defend your cities against incoming attacks. So a little tidbit is to make sure you put your silos, which are a very strong defensive force, in and around the areas of major population.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll do a pretty good job of defending against incoming nuclear missiles.
Yep.
Also, my favorite territory to play is Europe. Again, because of that very reason, because it's such a compact, because all the population is a really small area, it's very, very easy to defend against.
Mm.
Which means you can sort of just say, you can just like sit out most of the game, just sort of let people extinguish their nuclear battery, and then when they're sort of a bit down, or when they've gone to attack each other, you can launch a major onslaught, which works out really great.
Mm.
And the third tip is, when you're doing your naval fleets, because you can make naval fleets, you can make combinations of units.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a battleship, you've got an aircraft carrier, and you've got a submarine. Often it's quite good to put submarines in like little teams of two or three, and then sail them up to your enemy's coast, and then do a really quick surprise attack.
Mm-hmm.
And often they might miss it, because if you do them in teams, the submarines in teams of two or three or small numbers, they're quite difficult to spot.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sort of take on a number of different cities at a number of different points at the same time.
Hmm.
but it's really, really fun to play. And it's just, I think it'll be quite good. So, yeah, it should be awesome.
So, what are some of the other plans that Introversion has for the future?
Well, with the advent of making things a lot easier for small companies to distribute on console, we'd really love to see DEF CON on a third-gen console. Mm-hmm. We're working to put Darwinia on a third-gen console as well, for a download. So we're working on those. They'll hopefully be maybe sorted next year. We've got some multiplayer stuff for Darwinia coming out at some point next year as well.
Oh, cool.
That should be pretty neat. We're gonna add a lot of stuff to DEF CON as we go along. One of the nice things about digital distribution like Steam is that you can start off with a base idea and let your fans influence how you're going to continue to develop the product. Mm. So, for example, people might find that one thing they particularly like about DEF CON is missing one thing maybe isn't emphasized enough. And so then we can continue to support the product, continue to update the product, and just make the game a lot more fun in that particular area. Mm-hmm. So we'll be doing that for a good 6 months. And then we've got another game which we're planning to put out maybe about 2 years' time. I can't say anything about that, I'm afraid, guys. My lips are sealed. But needless to say, from the sounds of it, and I've only got Chris's, generally keeps his ideas very close to his chest, it could be really fun. In fact, we've got two game ideas. We're trying to figure out which one to do right now.
Okay.
It should be good.
So let's say, or actually, you know what? You mentioned the multiplayer for Darwinia that you guys are going to be working on. Are there any? Is that all you've got planned for Darwinia, or are there going to be more expansions available? Or, I mean, do you have any future plans for expanding any of your games?
We've always thought that Uplink would make a really awesome MMOG game, so that might be an option to consider in the future. Obviously, we've got the multiplayer thing for Darwinia, because it's such a small team, because we're like only 3 or 4 people. Mm-hmm. In terms of the development staff, we can't take on that much, so we have to focus on sort of very clear-cut additions and extensions.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely, after the multiplayer is done for Darwinia, we'll be working on some other stuff, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the things we really pride ourselves on is updating the games and just listening. When you're smaller, it's a lot easier to have to deal with your community. I think once you get a bigger company, it's difficult to find responsibility for people in the company to deal with your community, and stuff doesn't get transferred from one department to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas us, it's much more easy for us to get feedback from the fans, and then people, I think, people really like it when they see their ideas being incorporated into the game that they're playing at the moment. So. We'll definitely start off with the multiplayer and see where that takes us. But I'm sure there'll be some very interesting developments after that.
Mm-hmm. And that question actually was from one of our users who had a question directly for you. So that was from Pilot.
Cool beans.
Yeah. So it's nice to be able to, and actually for any of our listeners out there, hopefully we'll be able to let you guys know about our interviews beforehand so that you can submit in your questions that you want us to ask. So there you go. The system works.
Awesome.
Now, so let's say that one of our listeners wants to pursue a career in game design, whether it be in an independent area or even if they wanted to go off and work for a larger company. Do you have any advice that you could give them for pursuing that track?
Yeah, I think the key there is really experience. So Chris is our sort of lead developer, he's our creative guru, and he's had about 3 or 4 games before Uplink that he never, he was working on as he was growing up and learning how to code properly and learning more about what game designs work and what game designs don't work.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's always quite easy to find somebody who can program something, who can implement an engineering problem. Mm-hmm. It's much more difficult to find someone who can come up with a game and actually make it work and sort of make people who are playing the game actually feel something.
Mm-hmm.
Feel like an Uplink, this sort of tension and paranoia, or the same again in DEF CON. So I think the key would be to, either way, you need to make some games. You just need to give it a go.
Mm-hmm.
Try some stuff out and see what works and see what doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we'd say that the best way to do it is just to go out there and make your own game and then try and sell it.
Yeah.
The key there is to do something that's not been done before, because time and time again, I sort of meet people or people say, "I've got this really good first-person shooter idea. It's based on World War II." And I'm like, "This is not going to work, you know, because you're up against teams of 300 people who are spending millions of dollars a month to have a gun that's, you know, perfectly modeled and in it." So get focused on something. Focus on a cool, neat idea. Focus on a game. Game for being a game. If you get the idea that you might be able to make an immersive virtual movie, like the bigger studios are focusing on.
Mm-hmm.
Or if that's what you want to do, go and join a bigger studio. But if you want to have all the benefits of doing your own thing, then you really need to focus on an idea that's unique.
Mm-hmm.
And something, something that's just going to be is different. So I think that would be the my suggestion.
Mm-hmm. So, is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners? You know, whether it be about an upcoming release or future updates people can expect, or just generally anything?
Well, obviously, Defcon's coming out in 6 days' time. We've actually done pretty well with our pre-orders, so there are going to be a lot of people playing that when it's launched on the 29th, which will be at 6 p.m. GMT. So that's going to be really fun. That's going to be a really fun weekend. Even if you don't want to play, just come along and spectate. You'll be able to download the DEFCON game, and you'll be able to log on to the games and see what's going on. And that in itself is quite interesting. It's quite fun to watch people murder each other. So that's the big thing we're all crunching for right now. And then later in the year, certainly beginning of next year, we should have some pretty decent announcements about some console-related stuff too.
So just quickly touching up, because a lot of members were just a bit confused about how DEFCON is going to work. I mean, are we going to have a ranking system along with, you know, a place for everyone to meet and play games, or will people have to organise that beforehand, or is there just going to be a room where everyone can meet and organise a game on the spot?
Right, so we've got, in the game itself, there's a lobby where you can select a game that you want to play. There are methods, there are means by which you can form teams before you start the game, so you can already start the game in an alliance. There will be a ranking system as well, so you can try and pick people of your sort of same sort of skill level, if you like.
Yeah.
But that will obviously be improved with time as well, and we love the idea of having a really sort of high score leaderboard and all that sort of stuff as well, which will tie in. We designed it. We spent a lot of time on that particular bit to try and make it as easy as possible for people to meet up and match up and meet and play games.
Mm-hmm.
The learning curve for DEFCON is pretty quick. So, you know, if you can get it, you can get yourself up to a pretty decent level.
Mm-hmm.
Quite quickly, and it's like a game of chess in the sense that no two games are ever the same. So you're always playing different people with different strategies, or they might have a different territory which may affect their strategy, or they may be an alliance or something else which may affect the sort of way the game pans out.
Mm-hmm.
People should have a lot of different sort of games that they can play. So that should be great fun.
Yep. So, just about the ranking system, are you going to have some sort of system where people can actually work towards something? I mean, are there going to be unlocks or special things people can try to achieve?
Oh, sorry, I missed you there. Could you repeat that last question?
Sorry, is there going to be some sort of ranking system whereas people could, say, collect points and unlock things or have access to things that maybe other more novice users would not have?
Not at the moment. At the moment, you start off with a fixed resource. You start off with your silos, your units, and as you get better, you're just more likely to win more games. However, obviously we're very aware that you've got to keep people interested and keep people playing.
Yeah.
So we We've got a fast program of additional features we're going to be adding in over up towards Christmas. Certainly to keep all those people who bought the game early, keep them interested, and keep the game working well. Maybe we'll, with that boost, we did this great big Easter egg hunt. There were lots of sort of hidden in-game cheats and stuff, which people slowly found out. DEFCON will be the same. Can't give too much away there, but we've got a lot of cool stuff we'll be adding in. And as for distributing that against people who sort of, you know, the more successful players, maybe that'd be a really cool idea, actually, give those some additional stuff. Mm-hmm. Haven't really got any plans for that yet, but we'll figure something out.
So, sorry, did I cut you off, Bob?
No, go ahead.
So, just quickly, so very, very basically, the game is sort of pretty much, anyone who's got a basic idea of strategy, they can pretty much pick up the game, start playing. There's nothing
right,
too amazingly
right,
difficult about it.
Right, exactly. The game's been designed to be pick up and play. It's designed to be, let's say, once you've gone through the tutorial, which takes about half an hour,
yep.
You should be able to have a pretty good game.
Awesome.
And, let's say, depending on, as you get better, you refine your strategies, you sort of learn to play different ways. The thing, because of alliances, you know, it's almost as much as important to sort of have a persona, have a diplomacy with people, because, you know, you're playing against other people who are completely unpredictable. So, and if you can persuade them to join your alliance or persuade the game your way,
yep.
Then there's that whole aspect as well then. So as you become better known in the community of playing the games, you know, that will have some sway as well as to how the games pan out. It's a bit of an unknown, really, but I don't think anyone's made a game like this before.
I can't say that I know of one.
So I don't pretend to have all the answers right now, but certainly we will. What I can say is that we'll do our best to make sure, you know, that everybody, that the game continues to evolve in a way that, you know, the fans and the community suggest.
Great. Well, I'm finished up, Ramsey, unless you have anything else.
No, pretty much I'm done.
So,
okay, well,
thank you. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast, Thomas. And again, for our listeners, that is DEFCON is coming out on Steam on this Friday. I would highly suggest if you're interested at all that you pre-order it, because you get $5 off on Steam. And honestly, this is actually something else, Thomas. $10 for your games. I don't know how you can't buy them. You know, it's such a deal. For
right. Well, you know, with the exactly with the because it's our first game, we've got keys and stuff, so you know, it's we're able to reduce the amount of piracy quite significantly. But at the same time, we thought, well, if more people are going to play it, then you know, we shouldn't punish them. I mean, so you know, it's I think it's good value for money. So I'll leave it at that.
So yeah. If any of you out there are interested in Introversion and what they've got coming up, you can visit their website at www.introversion.co.uk. And this is truly an international podcast now. I've got me here in the States. It's coming up on 7 a.m. It's, was it about 1 p.m. where you are? It's about 2 p.m. there.
Yeah,
GMT,
it's about 2:30 now, and recovering from a hangover from last night.
And then it's almost midnight there in Australia, isn't it, Ramsey?
Yep, pretty much.
Wow, this is cool.
How about that? Awesome.
But that's all we've got, so we will see everybody next week.
The Steam Podcast is not affiliated with SteamPowered.com or Valve Software. It is completely independent and published under the Creative Commons license. For more information, visit www.steampodcast.com.